Welcome to The Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. We're beginning episode 2 on page 14 of this 247-page book. In our previous episode, Barbara Walsh introduced us to her father, Ronald, and to his father, Ambrose Walsh. Ambrose had come to the Boston States as a young man, leaving his older brother Paddy behind in Newfoundland with the rest of his family of fishermen in tiny Marystown. Ambrose, in August 1935, is in New York with his wife and newborn son, Ronald, and has just learned of the gale that struck his community hard. Barbara alternates chapters. She follows her own present-day research with her dad, the turbulent years of her dad's upbringing with Ambrose, and the story of the gale bearing down on Marystown in 1935. As we begin episode 2, we're in Marystown, days before the men set sail. Still, like most of the fishermen on Newfoundland's southern shore, the boys who followed Paddy on this Lady Day afternoon dared not test the skipper's ire. Careful not to meet Paddy's eyes, they cast a furtive glance at the skipper and raced toward the carnival barker and his lyrical chant, "Try your chance at the Wheel of Fortune, 5 cents for 50 cents." Children lined up at the wooden wheel, rubbing a nickel or two in their hands, dear few coins their fathers had given them for the garden party. In the shadow of the Sacred Heart Church, boys chased one another in a game of tag. Pennies jingled in their pockets, payment for a paper grab bag that might hold a few special trinkets, a comb, candy, or a bar of soap. Large wooden tubs held every child's delight, ice cream churned with winter ice from the bay and homemade berries. From long wooden tables, the smell of fudge and homemade apple pies beckoned hungry fishermen. Women outfitted in their Sunday finery, long dresses with buttons of pearl or glass, fussed over their baked goods. Nimble and quick hands arranged pies, cakes, and pots of tea, waiting for customers to buy their offerings. A line of fairgoers stood before Paddy's wife, Lillian, who sold her cakes to eager customers. A petite and proper woman, Lillian was known for her baking and sewing skills. Her goods were always the first to go at the garden party, and Paddy made certain none of Lil's pies went unclaimed. Across the field, a crowd of fishermen gathered around a large barrel of rum. Dorymen, who would soon be rowing miles back and forth to their skipper's schooners, stood in tight circles drinking from mugs that were blessedly full. Tom Reed, Paddy's second hand, sipped his liquor and listened to the voices that grew increasingly louder. Tall and blocky, like Paddy, the two men could have been brothers. Reed had fished with Paddy for many years, and despite their occasional brawls, fueled by too much rum or moonshine made in the woods, Reed counted himself lucky to be aboard Paddy's schooner. The winters weren't as rough when the skipper returned to Marystown with his boat weighted down with cod. There was likely to be a bit of salt pork on the table, butter for the bread, and maybe even sugar for the tea. "Aye, Paddy can be a rough character, but a skipper has a rough job," Reed thought. "He's got to command his crew and know everything about the seas, how to handle the waves when they grow to mountains, how to keep clear of the sunkers, and how to find the best fishing grounds. He worked ye hard, but he always found the fish." "Yes, boys, drink up," Reed and the men told one another. There would be no rum in the dories, where their calloused hands would soon be busy baiting and hauling trawl and pulling on the oars from dawn to dusk. The fishermen were anxious to make their catches before the long, dark months ahead. But they also knew it was the start of hurricane season, when tropical storms roared up the North Atlantic and descended upon the Bay of Fundy and the Grand Banks. It was bad luck to talk about the August gales, but each of the fishermen had heard the stories that were told and retold by those who sailed the sea. They had heard the tales about the gale of 1873, that struck the sea off Nova Scotia and Cape Breton, claiming more than 500 Canadian and American fishermen. The tide on that August evening rose higher than it had in 24 years. Ships as large as 1,000 tons and boats as small as 30 tons foundered or sank. Scores of fishermen were found dead, lashed to their schooner's rigging, or drowned in their decks below. Hundreds more were swept off vessels and met their watery grave. In the days following the storm, dead bodies rolled in with the tide. Dories and derelict boats washed ashore, empty and battered with holes. 100 more Newfoundland and Nova Scotia men drowned in 1927, when an August gale blew into the Grand Banks with winds of 100 miles per hour. Captains had never seen the barometer drop so suddenly. It was as if the devil himself had danced on the waters, surviving fishermen told their sons. The sea was as smooth as oil. By gad, all of a sudden there came mountains of water. We pulled on our oilskins and got ready for the boil. The wind roared like a freight train. Walls of water broke onto decks, stripping vessels of their masts, dories, and gurry butts. Everything above board disappeared into the briny deep, as captains hollered, "It's every man for himself!" Throughout the small outports, telegrams arrived bearing news of all hands lost. Word came, too, about the fate of vessels like the John Laughlin. The schooner from nearby Placentia Bay had been fishing off Cape St. Mary's with a 7-man crew and a young boy when the gale breezed up. A day after the storm, a fisherman spied the Laughlin bobbing in seas that were still rough and hazy with fog. From the rigging in the schooner's crosstrees, a man hung by his right arm. The corpse dipped in the sea as the boat listed. When the storm winds ceased, fishermen boarded the schooner and cut the sailor from the mast. Captain Albert Laughlin would be the only body found on the vessel. Laughlin's two brothers, the 5 other crew members, and the small boy had disappeared in the monstrous waves that had risen up beneath blue skies. The weather glass was no good when the August gales whirled up the coast. Without radios on board, there was little warning and scant chance of sailing to safe harbors. Fishermen faced the storms with nothing but the small crosses and religious medals they carried in their pockets. Still, there was no use fretting over the hurricanes when there were hungry children at home. Like many of the Irish Catholics, Tom Reed had a large family, 6 children, to feed and clothe. It was a struggle to keep enough food on the kitchen table. No, Reed told himself, no sense worrying about the gales and the winds that could flip a dory like a matchstick. Reed also took comfort in Paddy's resolve to come home with all hands. Aye, the captain never left a man behind. No, we never returned to harbor with the flag at half-mast. Paddy could be a son of a bitch to work for, but he never lost a man in his 25 years as skipper. Despite shipwrecks, storms, tick of fog, or treacherous ice flows, Paddy and his crew always made it home. Reed shook off the dark thoughts and joined the other fishermen at the rum barrel. Paddy nodded to Reed and grinned at the fishermen who were already unsteady on their feet. As sure as Sunday, Paddy told himself, the fists will be flying before dawn. The Farrells, Fitzpatricks, Brintons, Reddys, and Walshes will be carrying on decades-old feuds over slights suffered by their grandfathers. Beyond the circle of men, children's voices carried across the meadow where boys wrestled in the grass. Paddy searched for his own young sons, Frankie and Jerome. The sight of girls outfitted in flour sack dresses, rags mended with the odd button and tattered ribbon, prompted a curse and a sigh from the skipper. The boys were no better off with their frayed knickers and caps. The children's gaunt faces told of flour and potato diets with a bit of fish if they were lucky. The boggy town graveyard had claimed enough of them, Paddy thought. Their frail bodies couldn't fight off a cold, never mind the damned tuberculosis sweeping through the country. With spotty medical care and one doctor for 5 neighboring villages, few in Marystown hadn't lost a child or youth to disease. Paddy had grieved 2 of his own, Cornelius and Mary Bernice, babies stricken by pneumonia. His wife Lil still mourned the infants who had been buried 20 years past. The laughter of Paddy's son, Frankie, stirred the captain from his brooding memories. The boy sat in the wooden swing as other lads pushed the box, sending it skyward. Frankie's mouth widened into a grin, causing Paddy himself to smile. The boy didn't laugh often enough, Paddy thought. He's too serious for a child of 12. Paddy had hoped fishing would loosen Frankie up a bit, give him more courage, confidence. But the lad was just too sensitive. Frankie's stomach had betrayed him on last summer's fishing trip, leaving him ill and retching. "Maybe this trip, me boy, you'll find your love of the sea." Paddy had no worries with his older son, Jerome. If anything, the lad had to be reined in. 2 years older than Frankie, Jerome would have gladly dropped out of school to fish with his father. "Aye, there's plenty of time for fishing, me son," Paddy had told him. "Plenty of time." Before they headed back to school, Paddy had promised the boys one final summer journey. In less than a week, they'd be heaving the anchor, sailing 40 miles east across Placentia Bay toward Cape St. Mary's fishing grounds. If the weather remained fair, Paddy had promised he'd let his sons set trawl from the dory with the rest of the crew. Sensing someone's eyes upon him, Paddy turned to face a lone man dressed in black. The customs officer glared at Paddy and spit into the dirt. "Afternoon," Paddy said, tipping his cap. The local officer sneered at Paddy and muttered words beneath his breath. Paddy laughed, savoring the memory of the lawman's attempt to search Paddy's boat for liquor. Paddy had just returned from the nearby French island of St. Pierre, where rum was plentiful and cheap, a 50-mile sail from Marystown. Paddy and other fishermen often smuggled the booze home in the hold of their vessels. The skipper had never paid any taxes on his liquor, and he wasn't about to start now. As the customs officer stepped on board Paddy's boat, he grabbed the lawman by his coat and tossed him into the bay. "Jesus, you son of a bitch! I can't swim!" "I know," Paddy replied. Paddy watched as the officer flailed in the water, his hands flapping like a puppet gone mad. When it looked like he might go under for the last time, Paddy bent down and pulled the man back onto the wharf. Now, on this August Lady Day afternoon, the customs officer sought revenge. He glared at Paddy and weighed what infractions he might use to lock the skipper up for a good long spell. Perhaps this evening would provide an opportunity. He smiled at Paddy and muttered, "Bastard." Paddy clenched his fists and took quick steps toward the lawman. Before he could strike a blow, the skipper heard his name called across the field. The long black robes of Father John McGettigan slapped the priest's heels as he walked briskly to Paddy. Despite his stout frame, McGettigan moved quickly on his feet. His thick legs would serve him well today when the rum barrel emptied and the fights began. "You ready for a row tonight, Father?" Paddy asked. "Yes, I could see that you were ready now to pick a fight of your own. Don't you be starting anything, Paddy," McGettigan warned, though the priest knew there was no stopping Paddy, especially if the skipper had a few belts of rum in him. Like many of the Irish in Marystown, Paddy fought for pure devilment and distraction. Idle fishermen meant certain trouble, and McGettigan would have his hands full if Paddy joined in the garden party brawls. Of Scottish descent, McGettigan wasn't shy about using his fists to break up fights in his parish. Known as Father John Bull McGettigan, the priest had racked up many hours in the boxing ring, sparring with his older brother, a heavyweight champion. McGettigan's boxing skills came in handy on a Lady Day past, when a concerned wife knocked on the rectory door late one evening, pleading, "Father, you've got to come. The men are knocking each other out after drinking too much." McGettigan grabbed his axe, strode past the brawlers, and splintered the rum barrel to pieces. Called to assuage a drunk during another garden party, McGettigan told the liquored-up fisherman, "Fight me if you want more trouble." "I cannot hit ye, Father, ye being a priest," the parishioner slurred. McGettigan tore off his white collar and bellowed, "What's your excuse now?" Whether it was with his fists or his voice that boomed across the wooden pews at the Sacred Heart Church each Sunday morning, McGettigan ruled the rural outport of Marystown. The sight of the priest terrified children and adults alike. Small boys ran toward the woods if they spied McGettigan walking toward them along the dirt paths. Errant husbands received harsh words during church sermons, and unwed pregnant women were married outside at low tide water mark, publicly shamed. Instilling the fear of God and pastoring the small community had taken its toll on McGettigan, who grew fond of rum himself. There was little in the fishing village that connected the priest to his privileged upbringing in St. John's, Newfoundland's largest city. Educated in Dublin, Ireland, at All Hallows College, McGettigan hailed from a family of wealth and education. During his seminary schooling, he read fine literature and poetry. He studied Shakespeare, sang tenor in Ireland's elite choirs, and learned how to play the violin and piano. After he was ordained, he returned to his family home in St. John's, where he served as an assistant priest, enjoying the city's concerts, plays, and fine restaurants, luxuries that were stripped away when he received orders appointing him to Sacred Heart Church in Marystown. In the village, there was nothing opulent about the hens and sheep that roamed the dirt paths, or the pungent smell of drying fish stacked up on wooden stages that lined the shore. And the well-to-do priest soon learned that parish coffers would suffer among fishermen who could barely feed and clothe their own families. During McGettigan's first Mass, the collection box drew 13 pennies. Thankfully, a few wealthy merchants and fishermen like Paddy contributed more than their share and invited the priest to their homes for Sunday dinners. "You'll be getting a new pulpit when I get me next catch," Paddy had promised McGettigan. As the afternoon sun slipped behind the clouds, McGettigan eyed his friend. Dark circles rimmed Paddy's eyes, making him look older than his 48 years. "How much longer will you fight the sea?" the priest wondered. The skipper had talked about leaving the fishing to his eldest son, James. Over the past decade, James had earned his due. He had sailed with Paddy since he was a young boy, learning to navigate by the stars, the compass, and the glass that foretold foul weather. Paddy had groomed James to captain on his own, taking over the helm from his father. But McGettigan knew pulling Paddy from the sea would be a rough go. The skipper grew ornery when he remained ashore too long. "We'll be off to Cape St. Mary's next week, Father," Paddy reminded McGettigan. "Send us some of your blessings for fine seas and fair weather." McGettigan laughed. He knew full well that Paddy did not rely on God to save him in times of peril. When storms blew in, most of the Catholic fishermen stood on the bows of their schooners and made the sign of the cross over the mountainous combers, beseeching the Lord and the Blessed Virgin to calm the swelling seas. But Paddy had no use for crossing the waves. The more the wind blew, the more defiant he became. Paddy often climbed to the top of the mast during a raging storm. His face to the heavens, he would shout, "I'm not afraid of ye!" The skipper, the priest knew, relished a fight, whether it was with another man, the sea, or the Lord himself. Chapter 4. The Family Storm Unravels. New Hampshire, 2002. My father hunches over the computer, his two index fingers pecking awkwardly at the keyboard. He sits alone on dark winter nights, searching the internet for details about the August gale and his Marystown ancestors. He has little experience or comfort with computers, and his tap-tap-tapping is often punctuated with sighs and curses. But like any project or job he has pursued in the past, he grows obsessed with this task, and for hours at a time he continues to search. In part, I know my father does this for me, the daughter who is more comfortable communicating through the written rather than spoken word. The second oldest of 6 girls, I was what relatives called painfully shy. My mother often joked that I never uttered a complete sentence until high school. I took comfort in books, pen, and paper. While my reading and writing skills impressed my father, he sought to boost his timid daughter's confidence. Best man for his brother Bill's wedding, he surprised me with a request. I want you to write the toast for me. 10 at the time, I chose my words carefully, crafting a poem for the occasion. In a crowded reception hall, my cheeks reddened as my father lifted his glass and announced, "My daughter Barbara wrote these words." I remember the pride in his voice and the applause. Years later, after high school teachers affirmed my father's encouragement, I pursued a journalism degree. My studies went fairly well until I flunked a college magazine writing class. I had failed to turn my story in before grades closed. "You'd be better off pursuing photography instead of writing," the professor scolded. Devastated, I walked along the campus railroad tracks. My writing career was over before it had begun. "I'm changing my major," I informed friends. "I'm no good as a writer." My father thought differently. "You have a gift," he told me. "You're a writer." Now, more than 20 years later, my dad encourages me to tell his family's story, even though this narrative pulls him back to a past he would rather forget. While I continue to work at my newspaper job, my father explores Newfoundland websites, hunting for details about the 1935 storm and the schooners that Paddy Walsh and his son James sailed so many years ago. Hoping to piece together his family roots, he downloads the Marystown 1921 census. The 8 pages of surnames read like the neighborhood tally in an Irish village. Clark, Kelly, Farrell, Kilfoy, Flynn, Mallet, Hanrahan, and Walsh. Among the 343 people living on the southern shore of Marystown, there are 43 Walshes. My father's engineering mind methodically reviews each Walsh household, noting the ties to himself and Ambrose. He marks the pages with a pencil, underlining his grandparents, Thomas and Cecilia Walsh, and their surviving children, William Patrick Jr., Philip, Leo, Ernest, Angela, Cecilia, Ambrose, and Donalda. He circles their ages. In 1921, Ambrose is 13. His older brother Paddy is 34. The census lists Paddy's wife Lillian and their offspring, James, Lottie, and Teresa. Paddy's future children, Frankie, Jerome, Lillian, and William Patrick Jr., are not yet born. Of the 73 homes on the southern shores of Marystown, Paddy is one of two families with a live-in servant. The other is a wealthy merchant. With a bit of luck and his brother's help, my father finds a family member from Marystown, Paddy Walsh's granddaughter. On a Canadian maritime website, Jamie Walsh Willett had posted her email address and a note about her connection to the 1935 storm. Eager to talk with her, my father emails his second cousin, who now lives in Florida. "Hi, Jamie. My name is Ronald E. Walsh. I was born on August 12, 1935, in Staten Island, New York. My father's name was Ambrose. He was your grandfather's brother, 21 years younger. My brother, William Patrick Walsh, was born on January 20, 1945. He is named after your grandfather." After explaining that he is looking for information on the August gale and his relatives, he concludes, "I hope to hear from you." Less than 3 hours later, Jamie's enthusiastic response, typed in large capital letters, sits waiting in my father's email inbox. "Dear Ron, you sound like me. I am so interested in our family. When I go home, I love my people and Marystown. They roll out the red carpet for me." Over the next week, Jamie and my father trade emails back and forth. Jamie sorts out the confusing list of half-uncles, brothers, and sisters, and in between, she informs other Walsh relatives of her sudden connection with Ambrose's firstborn son, Ronald. In just a few days, my father receives a surprise email. The subject line catches him off guard. He reads the message several times before sharing it with me. Sliding the piece of paper across my kitchen table, he explains, "This is from Ambrose's daughter." "Ambrose's daughter?" I repeat, confused about this unexpected note from my grandfather's second family. I begin reading the words that are crammed in one long paragraph, as if the writer had dared not take a breath, as if she had wanted to share these thoughts for many years. Ambrose's daughter starts her note with an innocent hello, and I wonder if she refrained from using the salutation of dear brother for fear of offending my father with such an endearing term. Named after Ambrose's sister Donalda, she refers to herself as Donnie. In her opening lines, she explains that she had learned about my father through Patty Walsh's granddaughter, Jamie. I received an email from Jamie telling me that she has been speaking to my brother, Ron. I told her I have never met you, but heard about you growing up. I knew I had two half-brothers and always have been interested in knowing you, but was always a bit hesitant to do so, considering the situation of our father and what happened so many years ago. I don't understand how a man can leave his family and never look back. I was 12 years old when I found out about you. I am 43 now. The youngest of Ambrose's children, Donnie, explains that she has four brothers and a sister, Kathy, who is the oldest in the family. Before Ambrose died, he had many misgivings, Donnie says. One of his worst regrets was the sons he left. He said none of us could ever replace them. My father will later shake his head over Ambrose's sentiment, asking me, how the hell could he say something so stupid to his kids? Ambrose's words stir both anger and sadness in me. Like my father, I cannot understand how he would utter something so callous to his children. Yet I wonder how my grandfather's regret tarnished his life and his second family. I consider my father's half-sister, my aunt, who is 5 years younger than I am, and living thousands of miles away across the country in California. I imagine her carefully crafting her feelings, struggling with her own emotions and guilt. It is clear Donnie has a desire to ease the pain Ambrose inflicted. I'm really sorry that things happened the way they did. I hope that maybe we can get to know each other. I don't need anything from you except to know you and your brother. It has been a wish of my sisters and I for a very long time. You have been in our thoughts since the day we found out about you. Donnie ends her email explaining that she would love to receive a letter from my father, but understands if it is too difficult for him to write her. Just know, she concludes, that you are thought about very much. I wipe tears from my eyes, realizing my father's half-sister offers the apology Ambrose never uttered. In the months since my father shared the story about the August gale, he has also begun to share the memories of his childhood. He talks about his feelings in bits and pieces, recreating small snippets of time. I thought he was God, he tells me, recounting his early years with Ambrose. I followed him around like a puppy dog. I listened to these words closely, imagining my dad as a young boy, shocked by the abandonment of his father, his hero, the most important man in his life. I wonder what Donnie knows about my father. Does she know the details of his childhood in Staten Island and Brooklyn? Does she know Ambrose abandoned my Nana, uncle, and father not once but twice? I hand Donnie's email back to my father. He studies the words on the page and shares his reaction to her note. At first I thought, why is she writing to me? What am I supposed to say to her? He had no interest or desire to talk with Ambrose's second family. Why would he want to talk with the children Ambrose chose over him? This is the end of episode 2 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall. Thank you for listening.